A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are swapping the conference room for the coastline. We're diving into Rachel Carson's really remarkable nature writing masterpiece, The Edge of the Sea.
Yeah, this is absolutely essential reading, especially, you know, if you mostly know Carson for Silent Spring. The Edge of the Sea came out in 1955, and it's where her scientific passion just leaps off the page. She kind of pulls us away from just thinking, oh, it's a beach, and makes us look at what that space really is, the intertidal zone.
Right, that constant battleground, that fiercely fought over area where land and sea are always, always wrestling for control. Carson's big idea, her core insight, is that the shoreline isn't just a line on the map. It's a whole dynamic ecosystem.
Exactly. It's like a miniature version of the entire drama of life on Earth, all packed into that narrow strip. Hopefully, when you finish this deep dive, you won't just see sand and water anymore. You'll see this complex living laboratory.
Yeah, it really changes how you see a simple walk on the beach. Transforms it into like a profound exploration.
And to really get the weight of this book, you need to know a bit about the author herself. Rachel Carson lived from 1907 to 1964. She was an American marine biologist, a writer, and really a pioneer of the conservation movement. She got her master's in zoology from Johns Hopkins, which is, you know, pretty serious. And then she spent over 15 years working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She even ended up as editor-in-chief for their publications.
And what makes her writing just so powerful, I think, is that combination. She's got the really rigorous analytical eye of a scientist who deeply understood marine biology, geology, all of it. Mm. But she pairs that with the evocative language of a poet. She could take hard data and make it beautiful, make it accessible.
That dual perspective is absolutely key. The Edge of the Sea is the final book in her famous Sea Trilogy, and maybe the most personal one. Her authority doesn't just come from the degree, right? It comes from years of getting her boots wet, wading in tide pools, actually observing these systems up close. And this was the work she finished just before she, well, basically changed the world with Silent Spring.
Okay, so let's unpack the main idea. Carson's arguing that the seashore is one of the most densely populated habitats on the planet and one of the most intensely competitive. It's a world defined by constant struggle, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. The struggle is governed by these huge, predictable cosmic forces. The sun, the moon, their gravity pulling the tides.
Right. And the way the book is structured is really beautiful. It actually mirrors a journey. She takes us along the Atlantic coast of the U.S., starting way up in the rocky cliffs of Maine, all the way down to the coral reefs of Florida. And the narrative sort of zooms in and out. It goes from the big picture forces like geological time, wave physics, right down to the tiny details of how one single snail survives.
So it's really this interdisciplinary thing. You get marine biology life cycles, how things eat. You got ecology, predator prey stuff, the fight for sheer space. Mm. And then underneath it all, there's the geology explaining why solid rock supports one kind of life while shifting sand needs something totally different.
It's like a systems analysis for, well, anyone who's curious.
Okay, so to really get the complexity, we have to start with the basics, the fundamental constants of the shore. Carson calls it a battleground subject to elemental fury. Life there has to deal with two main things. First, the sheer physical violence of the waves, just constantly pounding, smashing, reshaping everything. And second, the predictable but still extreme rhythm of the tides.
Ah, and those predictable tides, that's what gives us the key concept, zonation. This is where it gets really interesting, I think, because different creatures can handle different amounts of air exposure or wave pounding. They arrange themselves in these distinct horizontal bands, like you walk just a few feet away from the water's edge up the beach, and you're crossing through entirely different neighborhoods, ecologically speaking. Exactly. We see that super clearly on the rocky shore, like the coast of New England she describes. The rock gives stability, sure, but those high tide zones, they are brutal, long stretches exposed to sun, wind, drying air.
Okay, let's look at how things actually survive that.
Mm-hmm.
Take the periwinkle snail. It's like the ultimate pioneer, living way up in the splash zone, higher than most other things.
Yeah.
So how does it not just bake or dry out for hours on end? Its adaptation is, well, it's simple but brilliant. It seals its shell opening shut with this tiny, tight little door. It's called an operculum. Just locks the moisture in until the tide comes back.
Clever. And then you move down just a bit and you hit the zone dominated by the barnacle. Now, the barnacle, that's a story about commitment, seriously. It starts life as this tiny, free-swimming larva, but then it finds a good spot on a rock, and it cements its head to the rock for life. Builds that little calcium carbonate fortress around itself. Then when the tide comes in, it just opens the top and waves these little feathery legs, they're called cirri, into the water to filter out food. It's such a radical specialization.
Wow, cements its head. That's dedication. Okay, so then if you wait for the tide to go way out, the lowest tide, that's when the low tide zone reveals itself. Carson calls it the natural aquarium of the tide pool. Here, the water never fully disappears, so you see the real richness. You find things like sea anemones, beautiful, yeah, but they're actually hungry predators. And sea stars, which are amazing examples of just pure persistence, slowly prying open mussel shells. Okay, so now we need to shift gears, right? We move south, and we also shift concepts. We leave the solid, stable rock behind and enter the terrifying instability of a sandy shore. Think mid-Atlantic coast. On the rocks, you had this crowded, visible community, but sand. Sand is a world that's always moving, always churning. Survival there basically demands one main strategy: disappear, hide. The drama, it's all happening beneath the surface.
Exactly. The whole focus shifts to burrowers, to life that can vanish quickly. Carson details the incredible mole crab, sometimes called a sand flea. It lives right in that messy swash zone where the waves crash and pull back. It's constantly getting washed out and then instantly burrowing back down to stay in the right spot. And it uses these specialized antenna to filter food right out of the water as it recedes. It's just nonstop motion.
Never still. And then there's the maybe the most iconic creature of the sandy beach, the ghost crab.
Yeah.
This thing is the master of camouflage and speed. It's nocturnal, hunts at night, lives in burrows way up on the dry part of the beach, blends in perfectly with the pale sand. It's a great example of an organism having to bridge two completely different worlds, land and sea.
Yeah, fantastic example. And finally, the journey in the book takes us to the tropical edges, the coral coast down in the Florida Keys. Now here, the environment isn't just something life lives in. The environment is actually built by life itself.
Whoa. Okay, so the living reef, it's basically a three-dimensional city, right?
Yeah.
Built over thousands, millions of years by billions of these tiny little coral polyps. And the whole system, the life of the reef, it hinges on this crucial deal, this symbiotic relationship. It's between the coral animals and these microscopic algae called zooxanthellae living right inside their tissues. The algae make food through photosynthesis, and they also give the coral its vibrant color.
It's a partnership.
It's a fundamental partnership. And we see a similar idea, life building the environment, on the mangrove shore. These mangrove trees, they're biological land builders. They have these amazing tangled prop roots that anchor them in salty mud. They trap sediment. They stabilize the coast. And crucially, they act as a vital nursery habitat for countless fish, shrimp, crabs. It really completes the picture of adaptation along the coast. So if we pull back from all these amazing examples, what are the big universal lessons that Carson is teaching us? What's the core takeaway for you, the learner?
Well, the first one that jumps out, for me at least, has to be adaptation and the struggle for existence. I mean, every single creature we just talked about is this little miracle of evolutionary design, perfectly shaped to handle insane environmental challenges. It's not just about getting by. It's about finding a way to thrive in really harsh conditions. The barnacle, you know, stuck in one spot forever. It becomes this metaphor for just persistence, for specialization.
That's a great point. And what's fascinating is how Carson always weaves in the immensity of geologic and cosmic time. She constantly puts the, you know, the frantic, brief life and death drama happening right now in a tiny tide pool. She puts that right next to the massive, almost indifferent scale of the millions of years that shape the rocks and the planets and stars driving the tides. That contrast, it just forces you into a much bigger perspective on, well, everything, our own lives included.
Yeah, it really does. And that sense of scale, that perspective, it leads right into the interconnectedness of all life. Carson shows us it's not just a simple food chain, like A eats B. Mm. It's this incredibly fragile, complex web, like how the presence of, say, rockweed, something you might barely notice, actually provides the shelter and the microenvironment that allows a whole community of smaller things to even exist. Everything depends on everything else.
Which brings up a really important question she implicitly asks. Are you actually seeing the world around you? Her whole work is basically a powerful argument for patient observation and wonder. She's urging us, pushing us to slow down, look really closely, and recognize that these epic dramas, these incredible stories of survival and change are often unfolding in the most overlooked places, right at our feet usually.
And she just had this incredible gift for language, for turning that scientific observation into lines that are just beautiful and they stick with you.
Yeah, definitely. There's one quote that I think really sums up her whole philosophy about how we learn things. She says, "To understand the shore, it is not enough to read books. One must go down to the shore itself, feel the force of the waves." That insistence on direct physical sensory experience being the only real path to true understanding. That's powerful.
It really is. And she could connect the vast to the tiny so well. Like when she says, in every outthrust headland, in every curving beach, in every grain of sand, there is the story of the earth. Wow. Suddenly, a handful of sand isn't just sand. It's the end result of millions of years of mountains eroding, rivers flowing, waves crashing. It connects you to deep time.
Exactly. And then there's the quote that really points towards Silent Spring in her later conservation work. The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and realities of the universe about us, the less taste we shall have for destruction. She directly links deep understanding, that sense of wonder, to an ethical need to protect. Knowledge leads to stewardship.
So, okay, let's bring this home. What does all this mean for you, the listener? Especially maybe if you don't live anywhere near an ocean. Well, the first application, I think, is about cultivating deep observational skills. This book is like a masterclass in how to look at things, not just glancing, but really seeing the complex systems, the hidden patterns, and you can apply that anywhere, a city park, your own backyard, maybe even the dynamics in your office, learning to see the details.
That's a great practical takeaway. And secondly, just engaging with this timeless, rhythmic world she describes, the tides, the seasons, the deep time, it offers a powerful antidote to modern anxiety, seriously. When you focus on these immense eternal cycles, your own immediate worries, those urgent human concerns, they get put into perspective. It's incredibly grounding, can really reduce stress.
That's so true. And finally, there are all these metaphorical insights you can draw from the survival strategies. Think about the ghost crab, managing to live successfully right on the edge between two totally different worlds, land and sea. Or the coral reef, you know, achieving this incredible permanence, but only through billions of tiny individuals working together, that symbiotic relationship. It tells you a lot about persistence, flexibility, interdependence, principles that work just as well in human life as they do in ecology.
So, wrapping up, what I really learned, or perhaps relearned from revisiting this book, is the enduring power of context. Carson just lifts you out of your immediate bubble. She sets our human timescale against this vast impersonal backdrop of geology and cosmic rhythms. And doing that transforms the shoreline. It stops being just a line on a map and becomes this profound, dynamic, meaningful world that really demands our full attention.
Yeah, and for me, what surprised me most reading it again was the sheer, unbelievable tenacity of life in that intertidal zone. I mean, it's arguably the harshest environment on the planet, right? Wild temperature swings, getting smashed by waves, drying out completely for hours, and yet it is absolutely teeming with specialized life that has figured out how to not just survive, but win. It just hammers home that the greatest power life has is adaptation. It's everywhere.
It really is. And ultimately, Carson shows us that the edge of the sea, that line between land and water, it's always moving, always shifting. It reflects that universal tension we all experience between stability and change, between holding on and letting go. So maybe the final thought to leave you with is this. How often do you consciously pay attention to the marginal spaces, the transitional zones in your own life, those boundaries? Because that's often where the most interesting growth and maybe the most drama actually happens.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.